Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Father Daniel, good to see you.
Chris, it's always a delight to be back with you.
You're just back from a pilgrimage, I understand.
Yeah, I had a pilgrimage to France, which was amazing. My first time going to Lourdes. Delightful. We had a really, really nice group of couples that went. And so that was beautiful.
I've been to France a few times, never been to Lourdes.
Yeah, it's exciting. And I'm getting ready to leave on a mission trip for Vietnam. We'll be there, over there for about 10 days, going over with a couple of our Lumen members and doing some work with some sisters over there. And Catholic World Mission to help the poor. And so I'm really excited. I've never been to Vietnam before.
Neither.
And, you know, I've read lots of books about Vietnam, usually tied to the Vietnam War. But to visit it firsthand, it'll be pretty exciting, especially because just a week ago, there was a meeting of key leaders from the government in Vietnam with leaders from the Vatican, working on a concord between the Vatican and Vietnam. So that would be a very, very interesting development.
But I can't wait to hear about the trip after you get home.
Yeah, I'll be excited to share with you and with all the listeners, too.
Well, let's jump into this week's topics.
Great.
I read an article about skunks recently.
Mm.
As we know, their defense mechanism is to spray a bad-smelling liquid when threatened.
It stinks. Oh, yeah.
So many religious traditions link foul odors with spiritual impurity or evil.
Mm-hmm.
In Christianity, sulfur smells are traditionally associated with hell and demonic presence.
Right.
St. Catherine of Siena, as well as Padre Pio, whose feast day we celebrate today,
mm-hmm.
were said to be able to smell people's sins.
Mm-hmm.
So we associate bats with vampires and in the underworld, or bats and vampires with the underworld, or with vampires, rather. Black cats with bad luck. Sometimes goats with witchcraft and the devil, because he's often depicted as, you know, having goat-like mm-hmm. features. So, contrarily, we associate doves with the Holy Spirit, lions with righteousness, and mm-hmm. lambs, obviously, with Jesus and purity. Do you think some of these associations of particular types of animals with sanctity or underworld are mere superstition, or do you think that certain types of animals are more preferred, quote-unquote, in God's
That's a good question, Chris.
Creation.
Obviously, all creation is God's creation. He has made it all, even snakes that are depicted as, you know, Satan in the Garden of Eden. So I think that there can be superstition, definitely, that comes into play with some of these things. But then again, there's also sometimes where there are historical connections to the demonic or to holy things. As you mentioned, like doves. Doves are consistently linked back to the covenant, God's promise, the Holy Spirit. So the dove is always a symbol of divine presence. That's over and over historically. So it's not merely a superstitious reference in that case. Or cases where you have horrific smells or certain creatures which are tied, like goats that are tied to the devil. There's a historical reference there. It goes back to the Old Testament. You know, you'd place the Israelites, the high priest would place the sins upon the goat and then send it out into the desert. And so the goat was that symbol of
the scapegoat.
The scapegoat. Literally, that's where we get the term from. So there can be elements of superstition here, and I think that's where we have to be careful and sort that out. But I think where there's a historical reference, or there is a canonical reference, if you will, we should respect that as well.
I'd never thought about skunks before. This was what the article was sort of like inferring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, skunks. I think they're benign in the canonical
sense.
They're
really cute, actually. Have you ever seen one up close? I mean, a lot of people will actually take their glands out so that they can just keep them as a pet.
Yeah,
they're kind of a cross between like a little puppy and a cat. We had lots of skunks around us where I grew up in Iowa, but they do stink, so you don't want to get
sprayed
by them.
This article was about European explorers coming over and encountering them for the first time because I guess they don't have them in Europe.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So I thought there was a European version of skunks, but
maybe,
I could be wrong.
Maybe it's called something different.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, whatever the case, they do smell.
Crossed wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed wires.
London-born Carlo Acutis, a boy who lived for just 15 years, was canonized as the first, quote, millennial saint.
How exciting. I got to see his body when I was went through a CC years ago.
Did you really?
Before he was even blessed, his body was on display. It was incorrupt, and I saw it there, and I was like, who is this kid? And someone explained to me, oh, he did all these displays on Eucharistic miracles, yeah. Really holy. And at that point, his cause was going through, but I didn't know at the time.
Wow. All right. Well, so many are elated at this official declaration of sainthood because he's so relatable to this generation.
Yeah.
However, there are some outside the church and even some inside the upper echelons of the church who contend that Carlo's canonization has been fast-tracked because the Catholic Church is so desperate to reconnect with young people. So you compare the other individual proclaimed a saint on the same day as Carlo, Pier Giorgio Frassati, who it took 8 decades to deem worthy of canonization, and many other saints whose cause for canonization have taken centuries. What do you think about the relatively quick canonization of Saint Carlo Acutis?
Well, there's always cases in the history of the church where people get fast-tracked, where there's just a widespread recognition of a person's holiness and the signs that surround them. Now, the church has a very detailed process for canonizations that requires a miracle, or two miracles in the case I think now, if I remember correctly, they've removed the need for the second miracle. So I think it's just one miracle at this point. But it's a very rigorous process. So he went through that process. So was it fast-tracked? Yes, but it met all the criteria. And I think that's what people can overlook there, maybe just trying to stir up a little bit of controversy or saying the church is trying to connect with young people. Well, the reality, God is trying to connect with young people, and God is stirring up holiness in young people in a remarkable way. We have, Maria Badano, is her name, or Carla, or Maria Badano, also a young person who was recently beatified by the church. So God is stirring up these people to holiness and to catch our attention and say, I'm still alive, still present.
Well, the guy that wrote this article before the canonization ceremony, the next day wrote an article about the talk and how he was a skeptic, or I don't know that he's a believer. And he was a skeptic about the whole process, and he was the one kind of with this angle of, did he get fast-tracked? And he was so moved by Valeria Valverde, who was one of the two miracles that Saint Carlo Acutis was associated with, that I think she had some head injury that was miraculously she recovered from after her mother prayed beside Carlo's tomb, that he the next day wrote an article saying, wait a minute, I think this is actually
pretty legit.
Yeah. So
it's funny how God works in people's hearts. Sometimes they've been a little bit longer to recognize it, but if the heart is open to the truth and to the evidence, you start to see.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. A recent Wall Street Journal op-ed worries that as more people turn to large language models for answers, this might choke off the supply of knowledge. So large language models like ChatGPT, Google's Gemini, they excel at locating, synthesizing, and connecting existing knowledge. They don't add to the stock of knowledge. By contrast, when humans answer questions, they often pursue novel avenues of inquiry, creating new knowledge and insight as they go. So they do this. People do this for a variety of reasons, like salary, like for wealth or fame. Okay, if large language models come to dominate the business of answering questions, those incentives aren't there for the model. Okay, is the author of this op-ed wrong to say that the supply of knowledge might stop growing?
I think it's a really interesting question, and it's one of the things that we should be reflecting on during this time. I don't see it necessarily reducing the supply of knowledge or new insights. I think what it's going to do is going to affect our capacity for analysis. Because when you have to work through a thorny problem, you got to look at the pros and the cons, you look at different vantage points, and you're through that whole process, it's an arduous process. You assimilate the knowledge in a deeper level, you understand the problem better. I think what it's going to lead to is actually greater superficiality. And as we reduce our capacity to analyze, to synthesize things, I think that's much more real and present danger than a drop in the supply of knowledge. Actually, I was thinking about that this morning. I'm reading through and praying through the John Henry Newman's book on Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine. It's really fascinating. I mean, he wrote this in the 1840s, and it's really difficult to read today because they... In the English prose of his time, of the 1840s, this is, you know, 175 years ago, it's much more convoluted, longer sentences, requires a lot more contextualization, and he couches things a little bit differently. And it's hard to read, even for me. I mean, I've studied a lot, I've got a doctorate, all those kind of things, but it's still difficult for me to read today. And I think I was thinking about it because the way that they thought back then, the way that they reasoned was more sophisticated. I was thinking of how I write now. It's in short bursts. You got to be simple. You got to be direct and to the point. So our way of thinking, our way of speaking and writing has shifted.
Right. We don't do long form analysis and hardly anything.
No, we don't. We don't have reason and logical thinking anymore. So we've already seen a progression and a shift to the way that people think. AI is going to affect that even further. There's no doubt about it.
There's a couple interesting parallels here because, so like in the stock market, the parallel would be index funds. So index funds don't do research and price discovery. They just track the collection of the value of a collection of stocks.
Right.
And in doing so, they exploit a market efficiency without contributing to it.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, when we rely on GPS for directions, we aren't using
how to get to places
our spatial reasoning.
Right.
But then the flip side of that is, I read this yesterday, that that surprisingly, ChatGPT researchers asked ChatGPT to solve Plato's ancient square puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And algebra wasn't invented at the time of Plato. So Plato's puzzle was solved by using geometry.
Okay.
ChatGPT came up with a solution from a different angle using algebra.
Interesting.
Yeah, and the researchers were surprised because that's not traditionally how you come to the
solution.
Right.
For
so so maybe there, you know, maybe
there will be new avenues.
Maybe there will be new avenues.
Yep.
Regardless, I think that there's scares around, not scares. There's talk about these, like I said, about index funds not adding any value. I think all of that's overblown, and that people always are coming to the forefront of the price discovery mechanisms, right, and market efficiencies and whatnot. And that'll continue always, regardless of index funds.
But I think we see here, Chris, a human tendency to be afraid of new technology. And we certainly hear a lot of voices about that with regard to AI in today's world. Like, oh, it's gonna affect this, it's gonna undermine that. It's technology, okay? It's a tool that we can use for good or for ill. And I think the Vatican has provided some really good guidelines. I was talking to a guy who's really involved in AI, and he read the Vatican document about AI and said, this was really well done, really well thought through.
Yeah, I don't feel like GPS has weakened my directional sense, but I didn't grow up with it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe...
It certainly has weakened mine. Like, I used to be able to navigate to a lot of different places without using GPS, and now I rely on it completely. Yeah. So I know it's affected me. And these new technologies do affect us. They do shift the way that we think, but they free up other resources for us to delve into other areas we maybe wouldn't have had time for before. And another really, really interesting thing that I'm seeing with AI, Chris, it's really fascinating, is so many people are discovering the fullness of truth in the Catholic Church because they're asking questions about scripture or tradition, and they're getting the real answer. You know, you ask Siri, you know, who founded the Methodist Church? And it'll tell you, John Wesley. Who founded the Anglican Church? Well, you know, King Henry VIII. And then ask, who founded the Catholic Church? Jesus Christ. You know, so taking out the filter of ideology is giving people more direct access to say, okay, this is the truth. Now, we always have to be careful because AI will hallucinate too. But the fact that so many people are coming to a deeper faith in Christ and the church through AI is really fascinating.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
The Napolitan News Service poll found a staggering 26% of those aged 18 to 34 answered yes to the question, "While it is always difficult to wish ill of another human being, is America better off now that Charlie Kirk has been killed?"
So you're saying that 26% of people say that the society is better off
of the thousand,
with an assassination.
Of the 1,000 registered voters that they did this survey
wow.
with. Yes.
And that was what age group?
18 to 34-year-olds.
So young people are saying that we can
registered
use
voters, yes, young people.
Political
yeah.
violence to...
Right.
Wow.
So I've been struggling to find a parallel to the reactions to mm-hmm. the murder of Charlie Kirk. So Ronald Reagan's shooter was mentally ill and trying to impress Jodie Foster.
Mm-hmm.
John Lennon's killer was seeking notoriety.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know about JFK's killer, Lee Harvey Oswald, because he was killed 2 days later by Jack Ruby. But he seemingly was also seeking attention as like a history-changing person. The list of assassinated people is long, but what I'm struggling to find a comparison with is this reveling in the assassination by broad segments of the population. The only comparison that I can think of was the assassination of Martin Luther King, where the vast majority of Americans were, you know, both black and white, were horrified, but there were some segregationists
small
who
segment,
were openly
yep.
celebrating. Can you think of any other parallel?
I can. I was just, you know, on that pilgrimage to France, and one of the things that really struck me was the Catholic nature of the country, but then also the vibrancy of the French Revolution, still very much present in society. And you look back at the history of the French Revolution and the killing of the king, of the queen, Marie Antoinette, and then the killing of priests and nuns and anyone who was religious, anyone who was nobility. I mean, it was a disgusting celebration of macabre killing and murder that is unprecedented in the history of the world. And I think we've glossed over and whitewashed the history of the French Revolution here in the United States. But you look at that history, gosh, you see this in spades. People reveling in the assassination, murder, and brutalization of other people.
So there's another like deeper angle to this that I wanted to explore, which is a subsequent article that I read that kind of might explain, you know, it doesn't justify, obviously, explain some of the thinking of people who are reveling
mm-hmm.
in this. So there was a 20th century philosopher named Herbert Marcuse. I don't know mm-hmm. if you've heard of him.
I'm very familiar with him.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he published books in the 40s, 50s, and 60s mm-hmm. detailing early thinking on critical theory, i.e. the oppressor and oppressed class.
Which is just a form of Marxism.
Right.
That's prettied up a little bit.
Right. So, but it did make me better understand maybe the mindset of how people could be reveling in this. And so in his writings, he declared that fascism and or authoritarianism as public enemy number one. In Marcuse's argument, he believed that people are indoctrinated by the inherent authoritarianism of traditional morality. So he believes that sort of structurally you're being indoctrinated by just by the fact that you are pro-traditional morality.
Right.
He had a cohort named Theodore Adorno who developed what's called the F scale, standing for fascist scale.
Mm-hmm.
It's a personality test to determine who might be on the path to becoming a fascist.
And maybe we should take them down before they get to power.
Well, so if one supported the traditional family or believed the husband was head of the household or had more conservative political values, they would score higher on the F
right.
scale. If proponents of the unprogressive worldview are allowed to speak, according to these two, they will reinforce the indoctrination and perpetuate servitude.
Mm-hmm.
That's their line of thinking. So Marcuse goes on to say that undemocratic means might be necessary to stop people and groups who are not advocate of progressive politics.
Right.
Namely, people who score high on the F scale. So
there's a long history of Marxists and socialists being of the line of Machiavelli, which is the end justifies the means.
Right.
If your cause is righteous and good, then you can kill, you can lie, you can cheat, you can steal. I mean, look at Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. I mean, it's blatant. He lays out very, very clearly, we don't have to live by any standard. We can just do whatever we want. And when you get into that type of thinking, when you have rejected God, you've rejected any moral order, you've rejected truth, the only truth is what you yourself dictate. that is a very dangerous world. But that's the precedent that we see on left-leaning policies and ideology all throughout history. So should we be surprised by it? I think what we should be surprised is how deeply that's infected many of the young people and many of our college campuses across the country. And I think that's what Charlie Kirk was trying to address in a very deep way. He was trying to point out and say, this is not a healthy ideology, a healthy worldview, and it's going to create problems. And it led to his assassination.
Yeah, I mean, the worldview would be that if you disagree with me, you are therefore
evil and worth killing.
Right. And so it's not worth discussing because just by nature of your disposition, you are undermining the progressive view without even saying anything, with just by living.
Right. Yeah. And this is a really dangerous thought because all of our democratic society is built upon the premise of that there is a truth. And that we can debate about it and we can come to and dialogue about it. So when you adopt a leftist view, which is my view is the right one, and then I can suppress any other speech, you get rid of free speech. And that's really the interesting thing that's taken place in our society in the last 25 years. The first book that I wrote was actually identifying what was going on with this, the initial part of cancel culture. It's the intolerance of tolerance. You know, while they were in a minority, these leftist groups were saying, oh, we need to have free speech. You need to, you know, be open-minded. We need to be tolerant. But as soon as they get into power with the worldview that they have, they will suppress the free speech of others. They will clamp down. That's why the Charlie Kirk assassination has had such a resonance in so many places around the world. I mean, rarely do you have anyone in these other countries paying a whole lot of attention to political figures in the United States. But you've got rallies going on in South Korea, in England, in Germany, in many different countries around the world. Why? Because there are leftist attempts to suppress free speech in many of these countries. I was at a conference back in February in England, and all of these intellectuals were talking about the suppression of free speech across Europe in what are supposedly progressive democracies. But as they've gotten into power, they want to shut down any dialogue.
Yeah, when you shut down debate, you know, as you often say, the truth doesn't need to be defended.
No, it doesn't.
Right. So
it just needs to be spoken.
Right.
And that has a power.
Well, and there's a way
own.
Of discovering it, you know, like the proverbial iron sharp, you know, men having iron sharpened iron by kind of discovering the truth and mm-hmm. you know, debating about it, because you don't have to worry about the truth ultimately. It's there.
That's right.
It's not something that you need to be afraid of because it is.
Well, you are afraid of it if your regime is built upon lies. And that's what you look at the history of the world. Every totalitarian regime, which is built upon a series of lies, is afraid of the truth. And that's why I think it's so very important for us to protect free speech. If someone disagrees with me, that's okay. We can disagree, but we need a dialogue about it. You know, we even have had a couple of disagreements here on this show, Chris, and that's okay. It's good for us. As long as we're both seeking the truth, if we stop seeking the truth, then that becomes a problem.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Another angle on the Charlie Kirk shooting. The Wall Street Journal talks about how the infamous Zapruder film on the JFK assassination wasn't viewed by anyone in the public until 1975, when ABC chose to air it 12 years after the Kennedy assassination.
Mm. Okay.
Back then, the media, because it was gruesome.
Mm.
Okay. So back then, the media felt some level of responsibility as gatekeepers for society. So I myself have not seen the up-close, gruesome video of Charlie Kirk shooting. My son called me and told me, don't watch it.
I haven't seen it either.
Right. And nor do I want to see it.
No, I have no desire to see it.
Right. So obviously we shouldn't be consuming things like pornography because, in part, those certain images, when viewed, are difficult to get out of your mind.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about how it's not just porn that we need to be refraining from consuming?
Yeah, I think that maybe we, as a society, it'd be good to come back to a greater sense of propriety. Not everything that can be seen, not everything that can be done should be done or should be seen. That's why we protect children from, you know, watching bad shows or violence, because it does affect the development and shaping of the human brain. Now, when young people are more susceptible to that than older people, because they have they're more established in their own identity. But it affects all of us. If you're watching glorified violence, it can diminish your sense of empathy for others, your sense of suffering. And so I think it is important for us to be judicious about what we watch, what we look at, what we choose to see.
Yeah, I mean, some of these video games that, you know, kids play nowadays are so graphic that, you know, I find it hypocritical when folks are telling you that has nothing to do with any rise in violence, you know, desensitizing kids to violence. Right. Right. And
some of these first shooter games, you're perpetrating the violence,
yeah,
and you're carrying it out and you're celebrating it and you're rewarded for it.
Yeah.
So, of course, that's going to affect the psychology of people. Now, they've done a lot of studies on this, and it does affect particularly people who are more destabilized. So a person who has a broken upbringing, dysfunction in their family, lack of friends, they're more susceptible to, you know, that are going over from what they're playing in a game into real life, into actually shooting people or carrying out violence. Well,
can you imagine, though, and that it's not that long ago, that it was 12 years post the assassination and before the video was widely viewed?
Now it's today's instantaneous.
I mean, right. It's no matter what,
right,
it's a rush to get it out everywhere. Mm-hmm. And there's just no thought about.
Well, I think there was some thought about it. There were people who pulled down the videos, encouraged people not to watch it. So I think there's a natural sense of propriety that some people have. But it is something worth reflecting on and talking about as a society. You know, a lot of times when the pornography discussion comes up, you know, people are saying, oh, well, it's free speech. We should be able to do whatever we want. Well, this is another area where, is it good for us as a society? Is it good for us as individuals? Probably not. The studies show that, and we should have a conversation about that.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crosswires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.